You're listening to the Musical Ecology's Radio Hour. I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and once a month we bring you a mix of conversations and musical selections by artists featured on the Musical Ecology series in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I invite you to visit our website for more information on our artists and upcoming events at musicalecologies.net. For tonight's program, we'll revisit our event on December 10th with Argentinian composer Marcelo Toledo. Now a resident of New York City for over 20 years, Marcelo is known for his complex, timbral-based compositions, which often incorporate elaborate notation. We began the evening with a lengthy conversation about his works and techniques, which he augmented with examples of original manuscripts and sound recordings. Then later in the evening, clarinetist Vasco Dukovsky performed a work for solo clarinet, which Marcelo composed specifically for him. But we'll begin our program with my conversation with Marcelo Toledo at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
So wonderful. So my name is Dan Joseph. I'm your host, and tonight we're happy to have Marcelo Toledo joining us. Welcome, Marcelo.
Thank you.
Great. And so tonight we have a bit of a sort of a hybrid evening, mostly a conversation. We begin all of our events here with a conversation, and tonight I think maybe a little bit more of an expanded one, as Marcelo wants to share with us a lot about his process and about his scores and techniques. So that's where we'll begin. So welcome. So how long now have you been living in New York?
24 years.
24 years, okay. So you're originally from Argentina.
Yes.
And tell me a little bit about your pathway to New York and what brought you here and how you ended up 24 years in New York.
I don't even remember anymore. I was born in Argentina, very close to Brazil, in an area of kind of intense nature. Mm-hmm. The Iguazu Falls are close to my hometown. I studied music there at the beginning, and I moved to a university in Santa Fe where I studied guitar. Composition was not part of the programs in Argentina at that time. I'm talking about the 80s. So then in Santa Fe, I started writing music with a band, which was a popular music oriented, mm-hmm. with some experiments.
Right.
And that was my beginning as a composer, without knowing I was actually composing.
Right.
So then one day I heard the music of Morton Feldman, uh-huh. in one of the seminars given by one of the composers who came to give seminars once a month. Mm-hmm. And I grabbed a copy of his essays. I didn't read English, but somehow I read it. I didn't read. And somehow some of this
came through somehow.
Feldman's talks and conversations and ideas came through, probably all wrong. Or something, but it was enough motivation for me to start it. I wanted to move from the very site-specific music that I was writing. I was writing music from Latin America, folk, jazzy, oriented, or something like that. I didn't know exactly what it was, but it was a fusion of things.
Right.
I was very happy doing that, but then one day I felt that I had to jump into the abstract, you know, mm-hmm. into abstraction or to a place where I didn't know where I was. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And specifically hearing Morton Feldman, an encounter with his music, that was really what turned.
Yeah, it just gave me the motivation to go in a different direction. Yes,
right.
Which was I call it all the time the direction of the unknown. Mm-hmm. Because that area was unknown for me, the other area was half known or more known, and that was the trigger for I didn't move to the United States because of that. It was just circumstances, personal circumstances that I came to the United States. But then I went to Syracuse, I studied music there. Then I moved to New York and I got into the doctoral program at Columbia. And it was writing music, and those years were very intense because of the complete isolation that I went through.
Just being in New York City or being...
No, I went to concert for 2 or 3 years, and then after that I will go once every 2 or 3 months and I will just stay home trying to find something. That was my process. I mean,
sort of a seclusion.
It was not voluntary. It just it happened in that way. I felt comfortable in a quiet space. Also, the coincidence was that I had to write music for a flutist and I rented an instrument. I started playing instruments that I rented. And probably from here, we can jump into the of this idea of the conversation, which is when I started writing music for the flute, I started making sounds that you couldn't write down, yes?
Right.
And then how I write that down? And, and the in the traditional repertoire of traditional, even contemporary repertoire of flute music, nobody was really exploring that space, except Charino, that I didn't know him at that time.
Right.
Not in that way. So it came together, the experience of sound and the need to write down that experience of sound. So I found that problem. How can I really write, I mean, express and at the same time contain the information that is expressed in this sound? And that was a journey.
So that became sort of your the focus of your work, really, is these kind of non-musical or unpitched or an expanded vocabulary of sound and how to convey that in notation or something.
Yes,
kind of.
I think what happened is that through the flute, I think I use the flute as an extension of my body.
Right.
Yes. I think everybody.
I think as all flutists do, right?
Yes,
I mean,
but they what they extend is not their body. What they extend is the music that is already out there.
Well,
so,
in what sense do you mean? I mean, certainly the physics of playing an instrument is that
yeah,
you're extending
but,
your body. But
when you take a flute and you say pa 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 pa, it's not your body. It's already music that is out there for 3 centuries. It's not your body. I mean, your body is only producing the air. What I'm talking about is that moving away from music, yes, and leaving only the instrument and your body as a kind of a dance between both, something happened there. And if you're not thinking about music, what happened is sound. And the sound is an extension of your body because it's through the air and the different articulations that that happened. And I didn't even know, I still don't know how to play in a normal way the flute, but that was not important. What was important was the air, the articulations, the intensities, and all the elements that come together with that, that is really an extension of what is inside my body, yes? For example, now, working with Vasco, who will play later tonight,
right.
He said, you extended my repertoire of sounds and possibilities.
Right.
Why? Because in a way I pass him just like a football, yes, a ball, my body into his body. And he developed, because he's already a fantastic player, he developed it even more into his own space.
Right.
But of course, without that experience, it could happen. It could have happened later.
Well, it sounds almost to me like there's an aspect of theater or of some kind of movement that informs the sound making. No,
I'm sorry to say that theater is not.
Not
interested
okay.
in theater, and I'm not interested in the gesturality of theater, because it's the convention of what is somehow sedimented through hundreds of years of doing this or that, yes? And that is, again, not your body, but it's a learning process that somehow shape you.
I understand. So I understand that.
But it's not, yeah.
Of
okay.
where you're coming from.
Yeah, no, because you mentioned theater.
I'm trying to understand how you're trying to express the body, and I'm looking for ways that might touch on other bodily visceral experience that's not musical. Naturally thinking of movement, mm-hmm. be it dance or theater or something in that sphere as having some relation, but maybe there's a different, maybe there's something more nuanced.
Yes, there are more details, and I think as you add another aspect of it, and I will say again, no.
Right.
You say, well, you're trying to express your body. No, really, because now that I'm aware of it, I don't do it anymore because I'm aware of that. It will be a trick.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm not trying to express what is in my body. That happened in 1998. With the flute piece, and some 2 or 3, 4 years after.
Mm-hmm.
And a collection of gestures and energies that were manifested through sound happened then, and then I wrote different pieces with those things.
Right.
And then later I moved into other things. But somehow it's part of that space that is manifested, for example, the piece for Vasco
mm-hmm.
is
mm-hmm.
inside that world.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not my body anymore because
right.
I just said to him, could you do this or that and this or that? It's an extension of his own.
Right.
So, sorry I'm saying no to everything.
No,
but
that's okay. I'm just trying to. I'm just
I will say yes
at
one point.
In 1998, you would have said. You will say yes at some point.
Yes.
Right. Okay, well.
Because
it's
you see, one of
required.
The things, one of the things that I learned with Feldman, who is for me the real teacher, is that as soon as you give a name to something, you are killing it, in a way. Yes.
Sure,
as soon as you are aware of something, it comes into another space where you are losing the innocence of,
right.
of what is manifested. Yes. And then you go back to that space. You can work with it, but it's not the same anymore. And I think when we put names to things,
right.
that is what started to happen. You know, things become
codified. And,
yeah, exactly. And
we
crystallized.
Them,
even in a positive way, they become crystallized.
Right.
And what is crystallized doesn't move anymore.
Okay. Well, so that leads me to a question about your scores and the relationship between that the score and the eventual sound that we're getting. So how much of a direct how literal or how repeatable, shall we say, is your score intended to be? Is it intended to be something that will always be realized differently each time or are you really trying to convey a specific sound that can be done again and again?
For every piece, it's different. For
right.
example, for the flute piece, that original 1998 piece, I wrote in a particular notation, and that is not the notation for that piece.
Right.
I wrote recently another flute piece that has completely different repertoire of gestures and even techniques. So it needs a different notation. I think every time, today as a composer, I think every time we sit down to write music, we shouldn't even take as for granted that we had to have the 5 lines, for example, yes?
Right.
So we start with a piece of paper that's black, white, or black. And then things, what you need to write down will happen, but without the history, even your own private history, yes?
Right.
So the need of each piece is reflected in the sound, the gestures, the et cetera, that is happening at that particular moment. And it seems, at least in my case, unfortunately, I cannot learn from the experience before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I put the score that I wrote, the last
right.
piece or the other one, that one that I like, I cannot connect that more than in an intellectual way.
So each piece has its own set of rules.
Its own language, of course, really. They are symbols, all they are related. Of course, I don't start from scratch every time.
Right.
There are many things that are
similar. But each piece has its own needs.
Yes, needs
that bring about new innovation.
Exactly,
in
new
situations. In your notation and otherwise. Yeah.
Because for me, I have this idea that if we assume that notation is a given, then we assume that we are in this space and this is the space we are going to move inside, yes? And we can be happy here, yes? Well, but then it's a given, yes?
Well,
we cannot jump into the wall and just, or the window or the ceiling and get out of here.
Right.
If you are limited by a space. And notation, when we assume as a given, which 99% of the composers do, they are happy.
Five staff lines, and the note, pitches.
So you assume that is given, and then you will move inside that world, like the little, what is, hamster that is moving inside a very small cage, you know? But of course, you can have fun too inside. Yeah, you can have fun. But for me, I think it's important to break those limits and start from other places.
Of course. Well, okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the history. I mean, certainly, you know, it's not, it's still in recent memory or this generation or our parents' generation, shall we say, that began a period of this type of innovation with notation, for example. I mean,
mm-hmm.
certainly, you know, much of the 20th century has all kinds of innovations. I mean, you mentioned Morton Feldman, leads me to think of not only some of his scores, but
yes,
some of his colleagues in the New York School, you know, the Earl Brown scores.
Yes.
So that there is some precedent, of course, for unconventional notation or graphic scores, different ways of conveying musical ideas outside
of the
five staff lines and the treble clef, right? So how about for you, I mean, your discovery or your sort of the beginning of your journey into this kind of expression was,
yes.
You know, it sounds like it emerged organically for you through your encounter with the flute
in some way. But, mm-hmm.
But and Morton Feldman, you've said, was significant. But how about, I mean, are there other examples
yes.
or other encounters for you that opened you to this idea of taking of going further with notation as you have? That's
yes.
I'm asking, I think.
Could I please just show
yeah,
you something? Yes, you see here, this is pneumatic writing from the
Neumes,
from the 1100 or
right.
even
very
before
original,
9.
Early
900.
Notation, right. Four lines. We're, you know, this is Gregorian
even, yes.
chant we're kind of talking
yes.
here.
But even before the lines, you see the little dots at the top?
Right.
Those were not with lines.
That's right, that's an earlier.
So, really primitive and beautiful manifestation of, okay, this sounds or whatever,
right.
Yes? So we kind of imagine without notation something. The problem with notation is double. Like, if you're extremely precise, I think you gain a lot of stuff and then you lose something too. When you are ambiguous like this kind of primitive notation, also you have room for exploration. So I kind of approach the history of a whole notational process in Western music, only in Western music. I don't know about other. I know that for shakuhachi music you can write, etc.
Sure.
And Indian music, etc. But you know, Western music is enough, super rich, and that for me was important when I learned about these things early on.
Right.
So, okay, they are trying to express something. Yes, why? Because they need to memorize and they need to communicate and what way they did it. And that, from that kind of notation, it went into the dots, yes?
Right.
The square notation. And when we have the square notation, what we have is a note. So you see, as soon as we got into the dots
right.
and the square we identify that as one note. Yes,
and we have different duration. These are durational distinctions now, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the most part.
Yes. The pneumatic figure is that one at the top, the two first in the left, in the right.
Right.
I like that. I like the gestural material. The other, the dot is too specific and it goes into one aspect, which is pitch.
Right.
So what happened with the history of Western music? It went into pitch for 500 years, yes, or more.
Right.
Straight into pitch. And the other elements that other cultures developed with incredible richness, which is timbre and texture.
And rhythm.
It came outside.
That's right.
Now, in the 20th century, we are back, or 21st, more. No, because in many ways, 20th century is the time when those things open up, yes?
Right.
The exploration of timbre, the use of machines, mm-hmm. tape recorders, etc. So the spectrum of timbre opened up, but there was not notation for timbre, except the ponticello, tasto, etc., of few instruments. Mm-hmm. So then, if we are working with timbre instead with pitch, we had to develop a whole system in which that can contain all that information. Mm-hmm. Let's say, yes,
for example,
it's like a melody, yes? And it's a melody that I can reproduce exactly in the same way. And if I ask Vasco, is this what I want? Well, I should be able to write it down too, so then he can remember, memorize, play, etc., yes? So that is the whole process that I went through. Of course, composers like Feldman and others experimented with notation, but Feldman was not interested in timbre in the sense of transformation of a timbre. He was interested in the pure sound of each instrument.
That's right.
And so he didn't develop that aspect. He developed notation through form and other things.
Well, and certainly a big part of his interest, well, when he was, say, writing graphic scores with, you know, there were different unconventional approaches
Absolutely.
That he explored, and then many, as I was saying, some of his close colleagues, you know, Earl Brown, John Cage, I think for them it was more, or a large part of that interest for them, it seems to me, was to create unexpected things. Indeterminacy was a big, they were trying to unlock the unexpected.
Yes.
So there was a desire to let go of control, in a sense. So that which is a little different. I mean, how does that inform your approach? I mean, is there indeterminacy? Are you trying to create that, or is this a more of a deterministic vocabulary?
No, in general, all my pieces are extremely notated with precision. So it's kind of a free control approach.
Right.
But.
Free control.
Freak
control.
It's very different. So, because what I did with my voice, I would like
freak
to hear
control.
That. Yes.
Well, what is freak control? What does that
freak,
mean?
Freak. Meaning that you are an absolute...
Frank Zappa freaks?
No, well, he was freak too.
Yes.
He was very, very obsessed with his music. He wanted his music to be exactly what he wanted. And I think finally Pierre Boulez played his music with Ensemble de Contemporain and was the peak of his career as a composer,
sure.
Yes. But he was also a player, yes, a guitar player and a singer. Yeah. But most of the time my music is completely shaped,
yes.
But few times, like in the case of one of Scores that is there, it has open form.
Right.
I wrote that piece and that piece is an open form. I didn't like most of the results, so I went back into normal left to right notation.
Right, so in that way it more resembles maybe one of the New York School composers in terms of the openness. I think that piece you're describing. Right?
Yes, but I don't like it.
But
I don't like
really
that.
But that's not where you're interested.
No, it was a nice work for me because it was... My daughters were born, and then I wanted to write something related to the stars, and I found the notations for constellations, etc., and it was a beautiful thing. But in terms of musical results, as I was writing a commission from the Wien Clan Forum Wien,
yes,
also in open form, I have 60 pages of music written in that way, and I was receiving these notturnos from different parts of the world, different versions. I didn't like any of them.
Mm.
So I don't have that acceptance like Cage, you know, everything. Right. So then I stopped that piece and I started from scratch, left to write traditional music.
Mm-hmm.
Traditional in the sense of notation, yes.
A timeline.
Yeah, timeline, yes.
Yeah. Right. Mm. Well, okay, well let's talk more about the visual aspect. So I feel that, you know, what I've been learning about your work, you know, in the last few weeks or months, it seems that in some cases the visual is, the score can be a visual work unto itself. There is, or at least to some extent, is that right?
I mean, yes, yes.
So,
well,
so you've exhibited your scores, for example.
It's not that I exhibited, but the dean of the School of the Art at Columbia,
right,
when I finished my doctoral piece that is there, my dissertation, he saw the score and he wanted to exhibit. It was not my intention.
Wasn't an intention, I see.
So he wanted to exhibit and he did an exhibition on that score that I would like to share with you. It's there. It's, I will show you later if you. But that piece was written for the Ensemble Intercontemporain. It's for 24 musicians and it's 99% noise, so I had to find notation for every single noise that I wrote for all the instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to say that in the tradition of the last 30, 40 years, there are two or three composers, European composers, that are very important in the development of noise music, yes?
Sure.
The most important is Lachenmann, yes, Helmut Lachenmann, the German composer. And his music is incredible, beautiful and rich. But then when you see the scores, some families of instruments remained in the past and some of them move into the future, yes? String instruments, for example. He does all kind of experimentation with string instruments.
Right.
Brasses are in the 19th century.
Right, they stay brass.
They stay brasses, yes? And at the probably what he does is into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Right.
So I felt, and this is the first time that I said it in public, that there was a weakness in that. That if we develop some instruments to that level, to that extreme, like transforming the violins, the string instruments into complete different instruments,
right,
we should do that with all the instruments. You cannot have a piece where the trombones play like a Monteverdi piece, yes?
Right.
And then the other one is in the 21st century. I felt that it was a weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And for my piece, for 24 musicians, I wanted to push all of them to the front in that way,
mm-hmm,
to explore each one of them, give them their new identity,
right,
and write down for them in that way too.
Mm-hmm.
So probably we can listen to at least 58 seconds of that piece,
which
are the three pages.
58, 59, you know.
Well, in 59 there is a silence.
Okay. 58 seconds.
I don't know.
Fair
how
enough.
To,
let's do it.
I don't know how to get out of the
escape.
You see? Escape couldn't be
escape
more
is important. It couldn't be more clear, right?
Yes.
It's just what it says.
So we're what are we listening to? Which
okay, word? I will explain.
Okay.
So this piece is called For the Encounter in the Abyss? I never know how to pronounce
it. The Encounter in the Abyss.
Abyss, exactly.
Yes.
Para el encuentro en los abismos. Abyss.
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 The abyss, yes.
Okay, what
the
you
other,
were thinking.
Well, I was thinking of the
in
an abyss. Worship. Place of worship.
Oh, okay, okay. No, this is the encounter in
the abyss. The
abyss.
This, the deep.
Yes. So the title is coming from many of my works are triggered by poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And this poet, his name is Juan L. Ortiz. He's an Argentinian poet who could have been perfectly a Chinese poet of the 11th century.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote only about his surrounding, yes, the trees, the birds, etc. But he went so far with his poetry into a space that is absolutely unknown in poetry. His complete work is a book like this. It's not translated yet. Okay, so of all his poems, once I read this line for the encounter in the abyss, and I thought there was exactly what I was doing. I was jumping into a space that was really unknown for me, and I did it throughout, and I accepted that darkness, let's say. And I think that that title, it was good for me to just consider it. And it was also an inspiration through the piece. Also, while I was writing the piece in 2003, Edward Said died. The piece was also dedicated to him.
He was at Columbia.
He was at Columbia. And of course, I was connected through him, not personally, but through his writings and his way of thinking and his defense of Palestine. And that was all coming together for me. And so when I finished the piece, I went to Paris, the Ensemble de Contemporain premiere. And then when I came back, the Dean of the School of the Art decided to exhibit the score. So the exhibition was the score plus the recording in a loop, day and night. So the people from the gallery were completely crazy.
Yes. And they had their own encounter with the abyss.
Yeah, they encountered the abyss. I just suggested they jump into it. So what I used to do with the piece is like I will give tours because the score is big and you can follow the gestures of the score and the densities, etc. So where are we? Oh, we are here.
Right.
And then it was interesting to see how the image was reflecting the sound, even for people who didn't read music.
Right. Is this the black score or not?
No, it's this one.
It's this one, yeah. Yes.
I said to listen to the 58 seconds because the 58 seconds are these 2.5 pages. So, first page, second, and the third.
Right.
So, of course, we can listen to more, but it's just an idea as to how the music will sound.
Right.
And I can put this or if you do what you want to do.
Thank you.
we'll stop here.
Sure.
All my pieces, all my music is in SoundCloud, are all these pieces in SoundCloud. I have like five different SoundClouds.
Oh.
So
five different accounts? Or
yeah, five different accounts.
Huh.
Yeah, so I have to have five different emails accounts too.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, that's wonderful. So that's the abyss, or I mean, your encounter with the abyss.
Well, the encounter with the writing of it. Yes.
Right.
With the.
So tell me about the writing, though. I mean, you mentioned the writer was very much engrossed with the environment, right, or the landscape.
Yes.
So in the case of this poem, is this an aspect of the poem as well, or is this something beyond?
You see that you are, and now I have to say yes, 10 times to you, and it's also a very, very important aspect of the music. Because I took that line from this poet who wrote all his life about his environment, yes? And when I was writing a music, actually when I finished it, Tristan Murail, the French composer.
He was at Columbia.
He was teaching at Columbia. And I haven't seen him for a while, like a whole year. I wrote this piece in 6 months, but I didn't see him for a while. And then I went to his place, he invited me, and then I brought the score. So he cooked, we have wine, etc. Everything was great. And then we went to his studio and I opened the score. And he looked at the score, looked at it, you know, all the pages. Like, this is a mistake. You should clean it up. And what? Yes, you need musical objects. Yes?
Musical objects.
Yes, like the French idea of the musical object is like coming from Pierre Schaeffer. Yes, the idea of musical objects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, well, I don't work with musical objects. And then I realized something that you'd say. Yes,
mm-hmm.
The music is the environment, and I walk through it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about discourse, and it's not about telling any story.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about expression, and even less my own expression, but it's about the creation of a space in which you can go through it, get in and get out.
Mm-hmm.
So for that, yes, I have musical objects that are very tiny, and they create a complete jungle of sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a completely different approach. And since that day, we didn't talk for another 2 years with Tristan Murail. But of course, it's something that I had to say because I know what I want, yes?
Mm-hmm.
So, and he probably wanted me to be kind of one of those gestural composers, yes?
Well, you were, I imagine you were in some kind of relationship whereby he was the teacher and you the student, or
not at
that point?
No, at any point.
Not at any
not
point.
Not at any point.
But you were...
I'm not saying it with this with arrogance, it just didn't happen.
Right.
I was already old when I met him. I went to Columbia and I was 32 or something.
Okay.
So...
But
he said, don't come to classes, just come to my place to cook and to drink wine, which is a perfect... He never talked about music,
mm-hmm.
never, at least with me.
Except
he probably said, with this wild animal, I cannot speak about talk about music. Who knows? He probably talked about music with other people, but not with me.
Well, there's certainly other composers in you know, modernist era whose work is more, as you describe, yours, at least in the case of this piece, as being a kind of an environment unto itself. And, you know, you're just sort of experiencing a kind of architectural space.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a kind of one
yes.
general way that much of this abstract mm-hmm. music of the 20th century is described, right? So in that way, I mean, I think maybe of Ligeti or something like that maybe would describe his music.
Oh, he also created beautiful environments, but extremely clean and very homogeneous.
Okay.
Yes,
but
obsessively clean and homogeneous, beautiful. I don't know, it's not my environment.
Well, but I'm just saying as a way of...
It's a good analogy,
of
yes.
approaching the music
yes.
and describing it as, you know, the theory,
well,
the theory that describes it, you know, that's what
yeah,
I'm talking about.
Yeah, I will
about.
Say there is a big difference, and I admire his music of course. But he was coming from the tradition of writing like the Ars Nova composers of the 13th century were writing isorhythmic motets and complex polyphony. Yes?
Sure.
So that's why his music is called micropolyphony. Right. His influence is that old tradition, put it into a space that was 20th century, etc. But it's coming from that place. What I wrote, I don't know where it's coming from.
Well, I'm just speaking in the sense.
Or I didn't know.
Right.
Sorry, yeah. Which composer?
We were just talking about Ligeti, George Ligeti.
Oh, the Hungarian composer, right?
Yeah, like Atmosphere, for example, is a good example of that. Or the cleanest and most beautiful piece.
What about Perez?
Oh, yes, I feel close to Perez.
I heard a lot of.
I feel very close to Varese. Varese is a beautiful, beautiful inspiration.
Well, he's sort of the original noise composer in a sense, or certainly one of the first.
He didn't write noises,
but
the result was noisy.
The kind of sonic palette that he explored was in that futurist kind of industrial noise.
He opened the door for noises as a possibility. The only noise he wrote was percussion music.
Right.
So, but for me, percussion music is not noise, it's percussion music. So that's a problem for me when I write this piece, when I wrote this piece, what the percussionist will do. Mm-hmm. How can I approach noise with percussionist? That was a whole subject, yes.
Right. Well, I guess every instrument has its challenges to make new again, right?
Yes, it's like working in the periphery of the instrument. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So if the percussionists are the most talented musicians in today. Yes, they are the incredible, versatile. They can do anything really.
Mm-hmm.
And Vasco here. And, yes.
And then there's Vasco. And,
yeah. No, really, and so then percussion music is as a result, acoustic result could be noisy, but it's still the known space of percussion music. What is noise for me, if I had to define it today, is anything we cannot tell the source. We don't know what the source is of the acoustic source, yes?
Mm-hmm.
So that is noise. It could be done in any instrument, it could be done with anything.
Mm-hmm.
But you close your eyes and you don't know what it is.
Thus it's noise.
That is noise.
Right. I see. Well, noise, I mean, as a concept, noise certainly has a lot of, there's a lot of connotations, I guess you could say.
Yes, bad and good, yes.
Right, right. I mean,
in general, more negative, yes.
Well, I mean, certainly in common usage, I think most of us would consider noise to be a negative. But,
yes.
But I'm thinking more in terms of social or critical theory,
yes.
You know, the kinds of, the idea of noise as a subversive, transformative force in the world, right? Countering the signal, you know,
yes.
or the narrative. I don't know if that
My poet's friends
you,
can talk about it, for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe that's. But you described it, your music in this way as noise. So.
Well, yes. The dissertation is called Composing with Fluid Noises, and for me it was important to say fluid because up to that point in 2003, all composers were writing music, including of course Lachenmann, music with noises.
Right.
They will all use noises that are static. They don't change in time. Coming from the influence of tape music of the 60s, yes?
Right, it's sort of acoustic music concrete for instruments.
Exactly,
this
what
is,
he called, he gave
yes.
that name. But then the sounds don't evolve. Yeah, of course, he is trying to avoid any tiny element of expression.
Or development, or narrative, is this what you're
Probably narrative
about?
Too, but also expression. Like if I do this.
Just neutral. Just
yeah, neutral. That's fine, yes? If I do this, which is in my music.
Then it's expressive.
It's expressive. And that is...
This is not Lachenmann.
It's not
Lachenmann.
Yeah, just the fact that I added that gestural element,
right.
it changed. And then I talk about fluid noises, because there are all these noises are transform in time. They don't stay static or dead. Yes.
Well, we heard, as we could hear in these, that was a long 58 seconds.
And it's a very important aesthetic, very important aesthetic distinction. Yes. So then when some composers who have little idea about contemporary music, even they know that they think they know a lot, they say they hear noises and they say, oh, like Lachenmann. And he says, no. I have discussions with Lachenmann about my music. Mm-hmm. And he say, Toledo is a very impure composer.
Impure?
Yes.
Impure.
Yes.
Conceptually, in the sense that you're not...
Probably didn't take a shower that day when we have a discussion. But no, I think in terms of, yes, that I use many many different elements, I combine them, they are all together, you know?
It's not a singular, tight theoretical structure that you're working
yes,
within. It's
exactly.
Like this freedom and
yes.
Experiment.
And if I'm working with Vasco in a clarinet piece, and a lion pass by, and it's a brrrr, is included in the music. He's talking about that kind of impurity.
Right.
What can come inside the music?
Sure.
And what in German music cannot be in the music? Yes.
Right. I understand. Well, again, I keep in our conversation. I keep thinking about, you know, these polarities, and one being occupied by John Cage. So where. I'm still not clear. I mean, Feldman is close to you. I understand that. But how about Cage? I mean, so much of what you're describing about your own work seems to echo a lot of John Cage to me.
Oh, of course. Yes.
So
both are important for me.
Yeah.
I just have, since I'm inclined to poetry, mm-hmm. I prefer Feldman. But
well,
then
it's expressive.
It's not enough it's expressive,
well,
but you go into that world that is a poetic world, yes?
Well, I mean, as
Cage... Like Cage said
well,
about Feldman's music,
too beautiful.
Your problem is the music is too beautiful.
Right, so that's a way of describing expressivity of some kind.
Yes,
I mean,
even
if
it's not expressive.
Case, in his
yes.
case, it was beautiful, or at least in John Cage's mind, and I think a lot of people could find a kind of beauty, a kind of sensuality in a Feldman work that's not... found in
Cage.
In a Cage work.
No, of course.
So maybe that's in your case.
I like both.
Some aspect of
I think I am in the middle of both things, and both worlds are part of my world. And of course, that openness and that looking for something unknown is coming from Cage, and the other part is coming from Feldman, because I am a purist in terms of what I look for in sound in each one of them. So it has to be pure and perfect mm-hmm. in that sense. Of course, then they get impure because they mix each other.
Right.
So just like human beings.
Right. Well, unlike the Germans, we're used to impurities here and mixing of everything here in the
yes.
Americas. Yes.
Yes, I think thanks to United States and thanks to all the influence of what is called the American experimental tradition
yes.
from Charles Ives, Henry Cowell, Nanka Rao Cage and Harry Partch, all the composers really put back music into, you know, into something interesting. If it was up to the to the Europeans, I think music would be dead. And I think what they brought is that space that was outside of history. So they brought something that was not included in history.
Right.
And it was in the landscape, it was in the real life, and it was in chance operations, it was in many things that were not part of history, at least in the history of music.
Right.
And without it, you know, music would be just history.
And that was my conversation with Argentinian composer Marcelo Toledo. We continued talking for a bit longer, and then clarinetist Vasco Dukovsky performed Toledo's work Entrañas de Centros for solo clarinet and tape, and we'll conclude our program with an excerpt from that performance.
You've been listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. For more information, visit our website at musicalecologies.net.